Hi, welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and video show which brings you role models sharing their leadership lessons, knowledge, and experience and wisdom. To date, we've interviewed over thousands of people around the world. And if you're new to the channel, please subscribe so you won't miss a new episode. I'm your host, Fritz Bussemaker, and today I'm delighted and privileged to have a conversation with Roy Mouet. Roy, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Fritz. Pleasure to be here.
Roy, allow me to briefly introduce you to our audience. You are the founder and CEO of Lifebook Memories, have a long background in publishing and logistics. And with Lifebook, you have worked over 100 autobiographies and memories, enabling your clients to pass on their stories to the next generations to come. Again, welcome to the program. And I see all these books behind you. So these are the books of the people which wanted an autobiography.
Yeah, so thank you, Fritz, and thanks for that. I have to correct you a little bit because otherwise I'll be in trouble with my wife. I'm co-founder of Lifebook, although I did initially start it for the last 9-10 years. She's been heavily involved in that side of it as well. So we better start off on that.
That is a very good correction to make. I don't want to cause any trouble at home.
And we have actually now done over 1,000 of stories around the world, and there's over 12,000 people who actually hold a Lifebook in their hand now today. So it's quite a diaspora who's actually enjoying their parents' legacy and stories.
That raises so many questions for me. But the first one is, when did you realize that there was a market for autobiographies? How did it start?
It started with this guy over my shoulder here, my father. So he was blind. He was 86. He couldn't taste his food, and he was quite depressed. And my mother, who was in nursing care, living below him in the floor below, was at end of life as well. And so I thought I'd come up with a project. I'd taken him out for lunch one day, and three times during the lunch, I shut him down. He'd start a story. I'd say, "Oh, Dad, I've heard that one before, not that again." And I was shutting his brain down. And then he asked me about what I'd been doing, and I'd gone to a conference in Frankfurt for my previous food business. And I thought, well, you won't understand that. So I said nothing. And I took him back to his room in the home. And I turned to say goodbye. And I was about to say to him, "Don't worry, it'll be better next week." And I thought, well, actually, it won't. He'll be a little bit more blind and a little bit closer to death. So I said nothing. And on the way back to the office, I decided I have to come up with a project, something to make him want to live for next week, something to inspire him. And that's where I created this concept for Lifebook and created the 12 chapters of his life. And I got my secretary to go and visit him because I was too busy to do it. And I thought he would talk better to a third party, which he did. And we got some amazing stories out of it, including the opening story about how our ancestor in 1568 became king of Poland for one night. And that's because the king had died and they couldn't be a country without a king. So they actually looked for a commoner without any issue, without children, and made him king. And he had never told us that story. So it made me think. And after he passed away, I didn't do anything with it. And he only lasted a few months. He lasted 3 months. And then my mother passed away 6 days later. So all that was going on. And it really came to the point where I decided that, having had a career previously in airline food, which wasn't particularly a value add to people's lives, I decided that I actually wanted to do something a bit more meaningful and a bit more purposeful. So I ended up going to a brain health institute in Toronto, where my wife's cousin was the head of psychiatrics there. And we looked into how could we slow down cognitive decline in elder adults by engaging with them little and often over a period of time and interviewing them. And we did some research with two of their researchers there on people within the within the organization. And what we did was we interviewed them and gathered that information. Their books, number 2 and 3 on the shelf there. But the reality was, the breakthrough was, how are we going to do this affordably and globally around the world? And the young social entrepreneur, a young girl who was the daughter of a friend who was with me, she worked out that if we deconstructed the interviewing from the writing, we could give a face-to-face, in-person human experience with the interview with your mother, father, grandfather, but at the same time use a writer who's actually anywhere in the world but has the background of an Irishman, a Jew, an Asian, whatever it was, so that you got the cultural nuance. So that was the breakthrough, because then we basically could afford to do this globally and anywhere in the world. And we now have customers literally from Hawaii to Mauritius and all over the world.
So how does this work? Is this an online interview you do with people, or do you come to their house?
Never online. Only during COVID, we had 47 of our clients move to online, and we sent them a tablet and taught them how to do it. No, the essence of this is that it's the interviewee, your parent or grandparent, must enjoy it. They've got to look forward to the meeting each week. And with any company in the world of any sort that does that on a global scale. So we recruit an interviewer who lives within 30 minutes of where your mother, father, or grandfather lives, your loved one. And we do background checks and we train them. And we appoint a project manager. And the project manager handholds all the way through the journey, the author, as we call them. And the interviewer goes in and visits 12 times for 90 minutes each time over a period of 6-7 months. Those interviews are recorded and uploaded to our platform. And the platform then notifies, sorry about those little signs that come up now on this. Our platform then notifies the ghostwriter that it's ready. So our best American ghostwriter happens to live in Rio, and he can do it at 2 a.m. It doesn't matter. He then downloads it, but he's got 48 hours to turn it around. And the key is, we don't use AI. We're actually using creative writers, professional writers, because as good as AI is at the moment, you can't get the humanity into the actual writing of someone who's been through the Holocaust and whatever story they're about to tell. So the ghostwriter writes that, uploads it back to the platform, the editor looks at it, checks it, and then every 2 or 3 meetings, that review goes to the client, to the author, and they check it together, correct spellings of places, or add another story. At the 10th or 11th interview, they end up with the whole manuscript ready, and they edit it together and sign it off. But the interviewer also has a scanner. And so they scan any photos or documents in the house. We don't take anything out of the house. They scan that, and that gets uploaded to our platform. And it's quite fun for the interviewee, the author, to caption them, to say, this was us on the beach in Scheveningen in 1927, and that's Dad's funny swimming costume and whatever. So all that information's going in the captions. Those photos come to us, and we use our designers to improve the quality of them, because the end of this, these books are beautiful handmade books, and they go to an artisan printer, and the photographs are fabulous, you know, something like that. That's my parents' wedding photograph. But wow. The books fall flat. They're stitched. They're on archive paper. They're not the kind of book today that you get to put your terminal up on your computer. You know, you can't open it and it's plasticky and breaks. And the final touch for me at the end is when they actually get to record an hour of their best bits. They're sort of, we call it the audio highlights. And it comes in a little pack like this, although we're upgrading that now to another pack. And on here is a 1 hour audio of them telling their favorite stories. And we put all the pictures back on there. in a beautiful way so that all those repaired pictures and documents are in one place as well for the family. So because our customers are traditionally elder adults, although a lot of children buy it for them as a gift, we never wanted them to be taken advantage of. So the whole package is all done for them, and they've got a project manager beginning to end. So it took 2 years to design that, but that's the integrity I wanted in the product.
Wow. Now, you said earlier, it started off with realizing your dad had a story to tell and needed something to live for.
I thought I knew all the stories. Yeah, and I think we all do. And the stories that a parent tells their children are very different from, you know, little Fritz, when you're always be that, you know, kid. You're not going to be that successful person that of everything you've done to date in your life. And parents talk to you like that. So, as you know, when you're in a situation with different people, and we often in these forum type situations, you give it up. You tell to complete strangers the real truth, the real stories. And within all of these, we've got so many documented stories where the kids have never heard it. Even the spouses quite often never ask each other the questions. So my mother-in-law and father-in-law did theirs, and then they swapped them, and they went to Barbados on holiday, and they're reading each other's stories and saying, I never knew that. I never knew that. So, yeah.
So that brings me to question, who at the end of the day is the audience? Who is going to read this book? So is that just the intermediate family, or?
Typically, it's just the grandchildren or the future as yet unborn grandchildren, typically. The parents typically think their children should know their stories and they should have asked them. So it's quite often for the grandchildren. Sometimes it's just recording a point in time. This lady who I'm going to see next week, I'm having lunch with her, Harvika Cole, she's 41. Her book's called Part One. And she's a fabulous story there. But then on the other hand, this one here, it's one of my favorite books. It's got an audience of two. This guy, Tony Atrib, was in Lagos and he died aged 42. He dropped dead in a gym. And his wife was 4 months pregnant with a 15-month-old baby boy. And they would never know their dad. So Karen gave us the opportunity to interview 26 people around the world. You'll see some art in there. That's art they collected together with the stories about it. So they got 26 fresh stories about Tony that the boys would never know, because she'll probably move on from those friends or life will change for her. And there are even little texts in the back which are messages he sent her when he was dating her. So 26 fabulous stories there from London, New York, Lagos, and Beirut. Three copies printed, one for her and two for the boys, and they're in a safe until they're 10. So the audience can be very different.
That is exceptional. So would you say it's normally the younger generation who gives this as a gift, or do you also see examples where somebody at the end of their life, or like the person you just mentioned, 41, say, hey, I want to share my story?
Believe it or not, to date, the average age of our customer is 82. Mm-hmm. They're buying it for themselves. They want their legacy to be told. And it is all about legacy. As you age, you start to lose control in your life of everything. The older you get, could be memory, could be physical aspects of your body, mobility, financial, mental, etc. But legacy is still really important. You want to know that you've left a mark here, that you will be remembered. And it's not about being famous. This has nothing to do with Lifebook. Lifebook Memoirs is not about vanity publishing. It's about private for the family. We only do 10 copies for families. Now, some people, we had one customer ordered 200 and he wanted to give them out to friends and family. That's fine. But it's still, these are not for sale. These are private published for the family. And that's the key differentiator.
Have you ever said no to somebody? I'm not going to do your story.
We've got into stories and we've said no because they wouldn't behave is a strong word. If somebody is telling a story whereby they're trying to whistleblow and on their time in the city or with bankers or whatever, that's not their story to tell. I mean, they can tell it. They can go to a publisher and get that done. But that's not what this is about. We have a lot of abuse stories where, you know, people were abused at a young age. Now, that is a story that can be told very well and has been used because it's helpful for them to get it off their chests. We encourage people to tell their own story. It's the author's version of the truth. So, you know, if somebody's telling us that they're brother-in-law was having an affair with someone or was taking cocaine or whatever, we say, well, you know, you remember that your grandchildren are going to read this. Is this the story you want to tell? And is it your story to tell or is that their story to tell? So it's quite hard because our editors and our project managers have to deal with this when somebody says, no, I want to tell this. But we try to manage that process as best we can.
Yeah, it's definitely a balancing act because I can imagine if somebody is personally influenced, affected by what somebody else has done, sharing that to the larger audience is indeed not necessarily helpful, but it's going to maybe help the person who told that story. So
I mean, there are two of the books we've done for two 30-year-old women, completely different stories, one Pakistani, one Chinese, both abused as children, one sold back to India, Pakistan, and into a marriage and escaped and raped and da-da-da. All of these stories. And both of these women have come out of it and been trained as psychologists. And they've had 50 or 100 of these books printed as softbacks. And they use it in their therapy. So, yeah, it wasn't for us to. We don't censor. And it's quite interesting because, as I'm sure you recognize, generations have changed so much since the 90-year-old parent that you may, you know, remember. The kind of things that were done in for 90-year-olds, the way they spoke about race, about religion, about sex, into sexism and such, all of those things were are dealt with completely differently today. So the effect of our editors and our managers and our project managers, who are between 20 and 40, seeing someone talking about things in a manner that they would find totally unacceptable today is fascinating.
And does that still get left in, or do you adapt it to the current time frame?
We are not here to censor it at all.
I'm just thinking of which was recently in the news about the books of Roald Dahl, which are now in some cases are quite offensive for some. So let's change the language, and then there's a debate: should you do that or not?
Yeah, I mean, one of our authors was a photographer that did the, I don't know if you remember the book, The Naked Ape.
Yes, and
the front cover of it, I could pull it out here, but the front cover of it has two naked adults, a naked 12-year-old child, and a chimpanzee. And that's a famous photograph which he took. The 12-year-old was his daughter. Now, you could not imagine in this day and age doing something like that, but it's in his book because it's his book for his family.
Yeah.
And I mean, the interesting story was more about the ape because he'd got that from the Natural History Museum and had it in a taxi to take for the photographic succession. But you do get things. We had another one where he had pictures of naked children in there, and we the project manager was up in arms and said, you can't put this in the book. When we looked into it, he was an orthopedic surgeon, and these were deformed kids or operations that he had performed that he was talking about and engaged with. It was nothing to do with naked children as such. So it's a tricky part of the job, because you're managing current day attitudes with a 90-year-old talking the way you try and change your grandfather's dialogue. It's going to be hard.
Fascinating. How do you define success in this case?
I was at lunch yesterday, and this woman sat opposite me and said, you probably don't remember me, but you did my father's book 13 years ago, and he died a few months ago, and that's the most priceless thing we now have. Yeah. And to me, that's like job done. You know, you've actually achieved that. I had a few phone calls in the last 6 months or so from people whose parents have become demented, and they're saying that the one particular woman was saying that her father was walking around the house with his book, with his life book in his hand, and he was actually using it as his memory. As he started losing his memory, he would turn to a page and he would go, oh, who's that? And that's your wife, Josephine. Yeah. Well, he didn't remember that. And he now was able to read about their wedding. Now, as you lose it further and further. But that's kind of a tough thing when you're going through dementia. You're losing your memory. And what this one person said to me, another one said to me that this was now her father's memory. You know, it was like put on a stick, outsourced, you downloaded it, and he had his memory even though he was losing it, so, which was never part of the original plan of Life Books.
I get that. So success is, in this case for you, helping others retain their memory, passing on their memories to others.
My personal goal, I've always stated, my sort of personal mission, vision, whatever you want to call it, is to help elder adults enjoy their lives a little bit more. That was my goal with my father. What it's transpired is that, and I'll just show you, there's over 1,000 of these. Yeah, this is not a virtual background. These are all people's life stories, and the ones facing out are the ones that we're allowed to show. All the vertical ones we're not allowed to show. And it's the legacy that we have given these families, and that enduring legacy of those memories. These books are printed on Mohawk archive paper, last 400 years. So unlike today, a video where, you know, your video of your wedding, you probably haven't got anything you can play it on anymore. And if you do, you fast forward to one or two bits. A book you open, you turn to a page, you look at a picture, you read a story, you put it down. That's forever.
Oh, that's actually a question I had prepared. So may I assume you see digital media, Facebook, whatever, not as a threat in this case?
Not at all. I mean, it's a bit like vinyl, isn't it? You know, vinyl is so popular now, and people are going back to that. And when you see kids doing this on a screen all the time, and how quickly they flick through and how quickly they move on to the next thing. I got a lovely video back from a customer a couple of years ago in America. And it was a grandmother, and she gave her son a copy of her book. She'd done it as a surprise. And then she gave her grandson one, and she recorded it. And the grandson was about a 14-year-old kid sitting on the sofa. He had a hoodie on with his back to the camera. He was in Nike shorts. He was barefoot, and he's sitting on the sofa, and he's got the book, and he's going, it's amazing, Grandma, this is amazing. And he's, what's it? And you don't get that today. You don't get someone pick up a book and flick through it and look at it. So no, I don't see digital as being anything I think the time people spend on digital appliances pushes them to want to pick up something physical. If you look at the data on Kindle and digital books, it's actually started to go down compared to printed books now, significantly.
Okay. In this whole journey you described, and at the moment we're just discussing what you're doing with live books, not even about, you could say, producing airline food. I don't know if that's a completely different story, but I was just wondering, in your life, what have been, has it been a smooth ride? Has it been a bumpy road to success? And if yes, what were those bumps?
It's still not a smooth ride. I think if you go back to the original concept, or not original concept, but original Roy as such, academically, I was a total failure at school. I was kept down to the age of 19. My teacher said before I did my maths exam that Roy's chance of a mathematics pass was completely evaporated. So I didn't even go and do the exam. I spoke fluent French, but I failed that because I was dyslexic. So being a publisher now at my age, if as a dyslexic and non-academic, is kind of crazy. But what that took me down was a path of, from the age of 19 to 25, 29 different jobs in 6 years. So I was really, really good at the interviews, but really, really bad at doing the jobs. And I kept getting fired. But I call it UOL, University of Life, because the people I met, the things I did, from driving a van and being on a kibbutz and being a restaurant manager and a barman and door-to-door insurance, all of these things, each bit taught me something in life and connected me with people. And so when I was 25 and I started my first real business, it was with a friend in a room in London, in the city, where we sliced lemons for British Airways for your gin and tonic. And we made pineapple juice in little cups for Iran Airways because the dairy would do it for orange, apple and grapefruit, but pineapple was too small. So the catering company was having to pour tins of pineapple juice into cups and put lids on and wipe all the stickiness off for 2,000 cups a week, I think it was. And so Gary and I started this business called Portions in 1978. And we had that contract for lemons for British Airways gin and tonics for some 25 years. And we grew it from two people in that room to 600 people in four countries. We were in Alphen aan den Rijn in Holland, in Paris, in two places in the UK. And then we opened up in the US. And it was a tough journey, tough business, ups and downs. As you can imagine, the airline industry, every time I grew it to a certain point, 9/11, we called it the seven plagues. It was 9/11, foot and mouth disease, avian bird flu, global economic downturn, the Iraq war. Every time you built the business up, you'd get about a 40% knockdown. And so eventually we decided to re-engineer it and outsource all the manufacturing. We sold all that. And then having done that, we were down to 140 people, still distributing the products that we were previously making. And then we decided that actually globally in the world, we were supplying all the food to these airline companies, but not the equipment. So we got together with an equipment company and we saw that they actually didn't have their own warehouse and they didn't have their own trucks. So why did we need them? So we got rid of our warehousing and our trucking, 20 big articulated trucks going all over Europe and stuff. And we got down to 60 people. And then we decided, okay, the airline said, are you selling us a business process outsourcing? In other words, a 4PL solution of logistics, or are you trying to sell us a beautiful double chocolate muffin? So we realized that we had to decide which we were. So we got rid of another 20 people. So we got down to 40 people. And those 20 people, we didn't get rid of them. We set up a broking company that actually did the brokerage for the airlines. And then we just had 40 people. And it was at that time in 1996 when the internet was just bubbling and no major company would allow the internet into their building. So British Airways and American Airlines and all these companies wouldn't allow them into their building. We came up with the idea that what we were doing was we were doing a menu catalog for each airline. So we had 80 customers around the world, Qantas, American Airlines, and we would do little Polaroid photos and put the spec of the orange segment or the whatever product we were supplying them on the photo, put it in a photograph album, and every month have to send this to 80 places in the world. And we came up with a concept to do this digitally. And we put it on a floppy disk and we created a little bit of software. We called it ECOPS, which was Electronic Catalog and Order Processing System. And we got each of our suppliers from Coca-Cola and Pringles and the vegetable supplier to pay £1,500 to be on that floppy disk. And with that money, we built the software, we created the catalog, but we also bought 80 Acer computers, those big green lumps. We shipped them to Qantas and to American Airlines in Arlington, Texas. And then through the dial-up network, you know, it dialed up the one to the other. So in the chef's office in Arlington in Texas for American Airlines, the chef had this computer which dialed our computer and which put in the, sorry about that, which put into the computer the floppy disk. And then he could choose our products. So we had a global catalog for all of our products. And the key was that if you weren't paying us £1,500 to be on our catalog, the chef would never see your product. So before any electronic catalog existed on the internet, you had this dial-up thing going globally. And we didn't realize it at the time, but we were obviously way ahead of what was going on in the internet world. And it then became EPIX, which was an electronic exchange when the internet was acceptable. So,
Roy, it's fascinating. Two completely different stories where you've been involved in. The mergers of internet in airline foods and the LifeWorks story. What do these two different stories have in common for you?
The main thing, there were a couple of things. The first thing was, if it wasn't for that airline experience of logistics, of actually managing supply chains and structure and how to do that, I wouldn't have come up with the concept of how to create LifeWorks on a global basis. Because I used that logistics knowledge to create the platform, to create the methodology, to... I describe it a little bit like a EasyJet or a Southwest flight, what we do at LifeWorks. We get you safely from A to B. Once you've placed your order, you sit back and we take you safely from A to B. Yeah, if you want some extras, you can order the Pringles or the speedy boarding or whatever it is that you want, but you don't need it. You'll end up with exactly 10 of those books and the audio, and you'll be handheld through it. You want 20 books or you want some extra interviews, fine, but you don't need it. And that was, for me, was key, because it's the integrity that you do when you're dealing with an elder adult. You have to, they're vulnerable. They're often vulnerable. Many aren't, but they can be. So that was the big thing. I think the other things are just that globality of the world. It is a small place and it doesn't matter whether... We had to come up with something which it could just as easy be in Hawaii as it could be in Sydney. We're doing books in both those places at the moment. So the thinking, and finally, we're very true to the fact that this is a human business with humans interface. Yes, of course, we'll use AI for the kind of back office things that everybody's going to use AI for. But we'll never change the human. We'll never do Zoom interviews for customers, because if your mother's breaking down about how your father was killed in a car accident or whatever, you don't want her to be on a Zoom call, and you want to be able to put your hand and say, don't worry, let me get you a cup of tea or whatever. So we won't do that. And We really believe that AI's got a long way to go before it can get the humanity into the writing that a ghostwriter can achieve, the creative writing, but creative in your voice so that it actually sounds like you. We don't want it to sound like anything else. So I think the blend of using technology where you need it and the platform managers. At any time, we've got nearly 200 projects going on around the world, all that quietly outsourced from people's homes and stuff. We only have four people in the office here. Now we had 30. So that was the big connection between the two. And I think finally, I said that before, finally, but finally, again, it's having some fun at doing it. You know, the number of testimonials you'll see on our website, the number of video testimonials that we've got from people, they're quite willing. I did three while I was in Rwanda recently, using the video crew that was there at this conference, and three people quite happy to go on video and say what it meant to them, their family, their legacy to do that. So I think that's very important.
Roy, it's been a pleasure and an honor talking to you about what you've done and how you're helping, how you're contributing to society to make certain those stories get remembered. Normally, I would end an interview with asking the person, what would your advice be to the young generation out there? But in this case, I'd like to ask you, what would your advice be to all the old people out there listening to this?
Well, thank you for that question because I'm passionate about the fact that the youth of today are pretty well treated and they've got a fantastic future ahead. Yes, there are issues around the world, but you know, we're pretty good at solving those as the human race. For me, the biggest pandemic that is at a risk to us all, we are aging more, people are living longer, longevity is there, lifespan is there. But health span isn't. And loneliness, to me, is the biggest challenge for elder adults. And to get situations where people can help their parents and grandparents into a situation where they are enjoying their lives, have a project, something to live for, something to look forward to, like I tried to do with my father, those some 20 years ago now. Something really to look forward to is key. And I think the elder generation is at risk of losing all that. Isolation, loneliness leads to apathy and accelerates the onset of dementias. So it's so easy just to ignore that elderly person in the corner of the room. They have a fabulous story to tell. And a story that if you take the time to ask them about, you'll be amazed. So yes, from Lifebook's point of view, my mission is to be doing 10,000 of these, not just 1,000 of them around the world, and to preserve that social history and that legacy for future generations. But what I would encourage elder adults to do is make sure you find those projects and do them. One, I'll end with one person that stood up when I was doing a presentation on this, and he said that his parents were elderly, they were lethargic, they weren't getting up in the morning, they weren't talking to people, and he solved it by giving them three chickens. And I said, how does that work? He said, well, every day they have to get up, feed the chickens, they've got to clean the chickens out. They've then got some eggs, so they cook breakfast. They then got too many eggs, so they give them to the neighbors and talk to them. He said all it took was three chickens.
Roy, thank you for such a great advice and sharing your story with us. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website www.tbcy.in to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the brand called You.